the Concordia Theological Seminary 30th Annual Symposium on the Lutheran Confessions presents Dr. D.G. Hart and his paper, The Drift of Neo-Evangelicalism into Mainstream Protestantism.
We now move back to the program, and remember with what great vigor our brother Kurt always spoke at the symposium, and the manner in which he was able to weave effortlessly together the magnificent truths of the faith with such a marvelous humor and the like. Well, I don't have that gift, so I'm just going to tell you a few things about our next speaker, Dr. Daryl Hart. Dr. Hart holds master's degrees from Westminster Theological Seminary, Philadelphia, from Harvard, and from Johns Hopkins, and took his PhD at Johns Hopkins as well. He is the director of honors programs and faculty development at the Intercollegiate Studies Institute in Wilmington, Delaware, and has authored a number of books, Deconstructing Evangelicalism, That Old-Time Religion in Modern America. I just read that recently, by the way. It's a fine book, my kind of book. Biography of J. Gresham Machen. And if you've not seen it, I highly, highly recommend his The Lost Soul of American Protestantism, which features a chapter on Lutheranism itself and looks at the, how'd you title that, the absurdity of Lutheran liturgy or something to that effect. But a very provocative title, but what he comes to, the point that he makes in that is that for Lutherans to depart from their liturgical tradition is, in fact, the real absurdity. And this from one of our Reformed friends. So will you join me in welcoming our next speaker, Dr. Daryl Hart, who will speak to us on the topic of the drift of neo-evangelicalism into mainstream Protestantism. Dr. Daryl Hart.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
My introducer was too polite to say so, but in moving from that tribute to this paper, we moved from the sublime to the ridiculous. The title of my paper was assigned to me by Dr. Scare. And it's also the case that the paper I haven't written, it was assigned to me to read by Dr. Scare. It's actually not quite the case, and I think I may have a surprise given the way the title reads. And as an outsider as to Missouri Synod and a Presbyterian to boot, as well as doing a subject that is not about Lutheranism, you may wonder if you have a dog in the fight that I'm about to describe. But it is possible to say that Lutherans were the original evangelicals. And so if you want to recover that word, you may want to pay attention to this paper. If the covers of American news weeklies are any indication, evangelical Protestants are now the mainstream, and mainstream Protestants, or mainline as they used to be known, are on the periphery in the United States. Back in the day, the Easter Week issue of Time magazine regularly featured a religious theme, and until 1965 or so, Protestants from the mainline denominations dominated the cover. Starting with Henry Sloan Coffin in 1926 and continuing with Reinhold Niebuhr in 1948, Henry Pitt Van Dusen in 1954, Paul Tillich in 1959, Eugene Carson Blake in 1961, and Running Out of Gas with Karl Barth in 1962, the Protestants who mattered to the editors at Times were the ones known for tolerance, ecumenism, and civic responsibility. That is, the ones in the mainstream Protestant denominations that belonged to the Federal Council of Churches, a body that changed its name in 1951 to the National Council of Churches. Since Barth's appearance, however, the only Protestants to grace the cover of Time have been evangelicals. For some reason, maybe because of his foul mouth, Stanley Hauerwas was not included in Time's online index of Christian covers. Billy Graham made his debut in 1954 and has appeared on the cover three more times, most recently with his son Franklin. Jerry Falwell also made the cover of Time in 1985, a time when the religious right was still apparently new. Of course, the evangelical vote continues to be news, and that helps to account for the most recent issue of Time to feature Protestant evangelicals, this time the 25 most influential of them. The February 7, 2005 issue of the magazine included, with the Grahams, James Dobson, Chuck Colson, and Rick Warren, among others. But for the last 40 years, mainline Protestantism has been invisible on Time's covers, a circumstance that could certainly be read to signify that evangelicals have succeeded mainline Protestants as the mainstream of American Protestantism. Parenthetically, if truth be told, the real mainstream of American Christianity, if Time's covers are any indication, is Roman Catholicism. Members of the Roman Catholic hierarchy were in the spotlight some 33 times, with John Paul II accounting for a third of those covers. In comparison, Jesus appeared only 7 times, which is 7 times too many for those Protestants like myself who read the Second Commandment as prohibiting all images of the Trinity. And that's, of course, counting the commandments as Calvinists and Jews do. For those decalogically challenged. But. As anecdotal as this evidence may be, it confirms the impression that practically any observer of American Protestantism cannot help but sense, namely, that evangelicals now dominate the religious scene in a way that mainline Protestants used to 50 years ago. One way to explain this reversal within the balkanized world of evangelical versus mainline Protestantism is to examine the winning strategy of what used to be called neo-evangelical leaders, such folks as Harold John Ockenguy, the first president of the National Association of Evangelicals, Carl Henry, the first editor of Christianity Today magazine, and Billy Graham, who all charted a course to make conservative Protestantism kinder and gentler and so win the hearts, if not the minds, of American Protestants. Another explanation, the one that I hope to develop in my remarks today, is that evangelical Protestantism has always been the mainstream faith of American religion, and that the relative isolation of evangelical Protestants between the years of 1920 and 1970, the era of the greatest combat between liberals and fundamentalists, was simply an anomaly or minor blip on the chart of American Protestant history. To make this case requires first some familiarity with the standard narrative of 20th century American Protestantism and the place of evangelicalism in that story. Yet from the broader perspective, the one to be emphasized here, evangelicalism has always been the dominant religious mode in the United States, in which case the emergence of born-again Protestantism in the last half of the 20th century to a position of prominence is simply a recovery of evangelicalism's original status as the faith best adapted to the American ethos of individual liberty, free markets, and democratic egalitarianism. Whether this state of affairs is a curse or a blessing will depend on the ears of the hearer. But coming to terms with evangelicalism as the mainstream American religion is important for any Protestant communion that desires to be faithful and discerning in its witness. Now, first, the standard account of neo-evangelicalism. On the eve of the Second World War, Anglo-American Protestants who were opposed to the liberal drift of the mainline denominations had a significant public relations problem. Most of the difficulty stemmed from the fundamentalist controversy of the 1920s. In the Northern Presbyterian and Baptist denominations, conservatives had objected strenuously to the equivocations that protected liberals from showing their true modernist colors. The Presbyterian conservative J. Gresham Machen, who taught New Testament at Princeton Seminary, was not the most demographically representative, but was arguably the most cogent in summarizing opposition to liberalism. His widely read book, Christianity and Liberalism, in that book, Machen identified the basic problem with liberal Protestantism. Quote, admitting that scientific objections may arise against the particularities of the Christian religion, against the doctrines of the person of Christ and of redemption through his death and resurrection, the liberal theologian seeks to rescue certain of the general principles of religion, of which these particularities are thought to be mere temporary symbols, and these general principles he regards as constituting the essence of Christianity. End of quote. Machen did not think the liberal defense of Christianity was necessarily wrong. He conceded that modern developments in intellectual and political life had raised significant questions about the truths of the Christian religion. The problem, however, was whether the liberal attempt at reconciling Christianity with modern science had really relinquished everything distinctive of Christianity. In other words, by cloaking Christianity in the garb of universal truths and moral sentiments, Protestant liberals had adopted a faith no longer recognizably Christian. As well received as Machen's thoughtful critique was, church and local politics were another matter. In the Northern Baptist and Presbyterian denominations, conservatives first tried to rid their communions of liberals and then created institutional islands of dissent within their denominations. Along the way, they gained the reputation for being temperamentally defective and intolerant, attributes synonymous with being unchristian because of Jesus' ethic of love. The only success afforded these efforts was the organization of new denominations, such as the General Association of Regular Baptists in 1932 and the Orthodox Presbyterian Church in 1936. Outside the churches, in the civil realm, conservative Protestants also lost a highly charged battle over teaching evolution in public schools. In fact, at the Scopes trial in 1925, the court found John T. Scopes guilty of having violated Tennessee law that forbade instruction in Darwin's ideas. But William Jennings Bryan's testimony on the stand, in which Clarence Darrow ridiculed the lay Presbyterians' simple-minded biblical literalism, combined with Bryan's own death a few days after the trial concluded, constituted the proverbial second and third strikes against conservative Protestantism. At the local level, these Protestants may have won the support of well-wishers and fellow believers, but at the national level, fundamentalism was a fiasco. Responses from the wider journalistic and academic world showed the liabilities of being a fundamentalist. H.L. Mencken was by no means an impartial observer and likely guilty of bad taste in his obituary of William Jennings Bryan. Nevertheless, his depiction of low church Protestantism in 1926 revealed the handicap against which conservative Protestants labored in the post-Scopes era. All I can detect, he wrote, is a rapid descent to the mere barbaric devil chasing. In all those parts of the Republic where Beelzebub is still real, the evangelical sects plunge into an abyss of malignant imbecility and declare a holy war upon every decency that civilized men cherish. What one mainly notices about the clerics who lead them is their vast lack of sound information and sound sense. They constitute perhaps the most ignorant class of teachers ever set up to guide a presumably civilized people. They are even more ignorant than the county superintendents of schools. End of quote. Roughly 10 years later, when H. Richard Niebuhr authored the entry on fundamentalism for the Encyclopedia of Social Sciences, the perception of backwardness and ignorance still afflicted conservative Protestantism. According to Niebuhr, who was, it should be added, hardly a social scientist, quote, fundamentalism was closely related to the conflict between rural and urban churches in America. Its popular leader was William Jennings Bryan. Its rise coincided with the depression of agricultural values after the World War. It achieved little strength in the urban and industrial sections of the country, but was active in many rural states. Fundamentalism in its aggressive forms was most prevalent in those isolated communities in which the traditions of pioneer society had been most effectively preserved, and which were least subject to the influence of modern science and industrial civilization, end of quote. If conservative Protestants were going to gain any credibility in the mainstream of American society, they needed a serious makeover. Enter stage center right, a band of Protestant leaders, sometimes oxymoronically referred to as progressive fundamentalists. In the early 1940s, these conservatives sought a strategy to project a less acerbic and gentler version of the faith once delivered. The creation in 1942 of the National Association of Evangelicals, and hereafter I'll say NAE, so I don't have to say that whole phrase, was indicative of the shift among conservative Protestants and the desire for a better public image. The founders of the organization, such men as J. Elwin Wright, the leader of the New England Fellowship and a real estate developer, Harold Ockingay, pastor of Boston's historic Park Street Church, and Will Houghton, president of Moody Bible Institute, wanted to go beyond fundamentalist truculence and unite conservatives in the larger and more important project of evangelizing a lost nation. For these neo-evangelicals, as they were called, the old fundamentalist agenda of opposing theological liberalism was too narrow. If conservatives were going to restore Christianity in America, they would have to find a more positive and attractive rationale. As Stephen W. Payne, president of Houghton College, said at the NAE's first conference, quote, many sincere Christians are impelled to united action by negative motives. But such movements always lack cohesive qualities, and for that reason, constructively minded Christians hesitated joining them. End of quote. What Payne most likely had in mind was the American Council of Christian Churches, formed in 1941 by Carl McIntyre, a Presbyterian fundamentalist and anti-communist extraordinaire who had been forced into ecclesiastical exile during the 1930s controversy over Presbyterian foreign missions. Resentful of the Federal Council of Churches' claim to speak for all American Protestants, McIntyre built his organization upon opposition to theological liberalism and made formal repudiation of the Federal Council a requirement for membership in his American Council. McIntyre had tried to enlist the support of the National Association of Evangelicals leaders, but the latter decided that McIntyre's agenda was too militant. The NAE acknowledged that the Federal Council was tainted by modernism, hence the need for an interdenominational agency. But neo-evangelicals would permit their members to retain affiliation with the mainline churches. As such, the new evangelical project was much less pessimistic than fundamentalism about the possibility and value of changing American society. The leaders of the NAE wanted to leave behind the fundamentalist ghetto and play an active role, as Ockingay phrased it, in affecting, quote, the whole future course of evangelical Christianity in America, end of quote. An important book that summarized the new evangelical enterprise was Carl F.H. Henry's The Uneasy Conscience of Modern Fundamentalism, published in 1947. Henry's book, described by one historian as neo-evangelicalism's manifesto, was a direct and confrontational plea for conservatives to move beyond narrow concerns and respond to the needs of the post-war world. He argued that the collapse of Western civilization, as evidenced by war-torn Europe, provided conservatives with a tremendous opportunity. Fundamentalists had failed to respond to that crisis. They were still debating whether it is right to play rook while nations of the world are playing with fire. Henry warned neo-evangelicals that unless they move beyond issues of ecclesiastical purity and personal morality, the gospel would be dismissed as irrelevant. The remedy was an evangelical faith that yoked social reform to evangelism. From Henry's vantage, the new evangelicalism was not a complete repudiation of fundamentalism, but a new and improved version. For what still united the older fundamentalists and the new evangelicals was revivalism, a distinctive brand of Anglo-American Protestantism that stressed conversion and the personal experience of grace, distrusted ecclesiastical institutions and theological tradition, and encouraged a new style of religious leadership that depended on mass appeal and personal charisma. In the context of America's religious disestablishment during the Revolutionary era, revivalism proved to be particularly effective for churches to recruit new members. By the 20th century, revivalism had become marginal. The fundamentalist controversy stemmed in part from the perception among conservatives that mainline churches had abandoned the religious work of soul winning for the worldly pursuits of social reform and science. The optimistic and triumphalist mood of 19th century evangelicalism by the 1920s had been tempered by a sense that fundamentalists were a faithful remnant that needed to hunker down and wait for the Lord's return. Yet fundamentalists persevered. Revivalism sustained them in the hard times of the 1930s and propelled new evangelical efforts of the 1940s. The founders of the NAE were no less hostile to modernism than card-carrying fundamentalists. In fact, antagonism toward liberalism was an important part of neo-evangelicalism's rhetoric. But the new evangelicals had also learned a few lessons since the Scopes trial. They saw that the Crusades of the 1920s had been ineffective and had taken away precious time from the more important task of evangelism. The new medium of radio was especially important in redirecting fundamentalists away from polemics by convincing them of the benefits of civility and broad-based appeal. Indeed, the most popular preachers on the airwaves in the 1930s, such fundamentalists as Will Houghton, pastor at Chicago's Moody Church before becoming president of Moody Bible Institute, Charles Fuller, speaker on the old-fashioned revival hour, discovered that evangelistic sermons, snappy gospel quartets, and a folksy style were more effective than the stentorian harangues of a Billy Sunday or a Carl McIntyre. The founding of the NAE tapped this revivalist resurgence. Evangelism was prominent in the association's rationale, as its leaders hoped to unite conservatives in programs that would convert individuals, defeat secularism and modernism, and restore America to its Christian past. And providing cover for radio evangelists would be one of the most important jobs the NAE would perform. New evangelical leaders believed that a significant threat to national revival was the increasing restriction that radio networks were placing upon their popular preachers. For a time in the early 1940s, it looked as if the Federal Council of Churches would be the principal agency for determining which preachers would have access to the national airwaves, thus relegating evangelicals to local stations. The NAE then would vie to become a second major Protestant voice and represent evangelical preachers to the Federal Communications Commission. In a similar fashion, the NAE established an office that functioned as a liaison with the military so that evangelical ministers could serve as chaplains. It also facilitated foreign missions by assisting missionaries in a variety of legal and bureaucratic matters. In effect, the NAE was the evangelical version of the Federal Council of Churches. While committed to revival, the NAE also nurtured a sense of responsibility for public affairs that the next generation of evangelicals would aspire to and in some cases achieve. The new evangelicals challenged fundamentalists to look beyond their religious ghetto to social and cultural concerns of the mainstream. Their subsequent public involvement, academic accomplishments, and willing to cooperate with or at least tolerate the Protestant establishment were the first signs of a chastened or reformed fundamentalism, one that was still conservative in religious matters, but more socially engaged. To say that after the founding of the NAE, the rest of evangelicalism's success is history would be simplistic. The other institutions that neo-evangelical leaders formed to cultivate their identity and networks were Fuller Seminary in 1947, Christianity Today, which started in 1956. These institutions reflected the intellectual aspirations of neo-evangelicals and their conviction that nurturing the life of the mind through theological education and sustained theological reflection in a magazine format would allow the better sort of conservative Protestants to achieve a sense of belonging to a broader and more influential movement. Yet as successful as these institutions have been on their own terms, and that's in question, I think, evangelicalism would not have achieved notoriety without the success of Billy Graham. Some academics have surmised that the best way to define born-again Protestantism is to say that an evangelical is anyone who likes Billy Graham, or in other words, has a personal relationship with Billy. In fact, the size of his crusades, the variety of the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association's endeavors in radio, film, and print, the coverage he received from the media, and the access he had to American presidents and world leaders gave all those Protestants who liked him a sense not only of belonging to something bigger than their local congregation, but also a conviction that evangelicalism was progressively expanding the Lord's work. A longer account of neo-evangelicalism's success than the one offered here should provide ample qualifications. One would be that evangelicalism of the NAE, Fuller Seminary, and Christianity Today variety is by no means the only kind of born-again Protestantism. Sizable numbers of Wesleyans, Holiness, Pentecostals, and African-American Protestants, all of whom believe in the necessity of being born again, as revivalists insist, have likely never subscribed to Christianity Today or called their pastor from the graduates of Fuller Seminary. At the same time, the rise of the religious right since Ronald Reagan's victory in 1980 has given evangelicalism popularity and influence that neo-evangelical leaders never expected and about which they are likely ambivalent. Even so, by acquiring property rights to the word evangelical, a term employed previously by liberal Protestants as much as conservatives, neo-evangelicals salvaged the reputation of a religious style that in 1925 appeared to belong to the backwoods and backwater of American culture. So that's the bit on neo-evangelicalism. Now for a broader perspective on evangelicalism more generally. As significant an accomplishment as the recovery of evangelicalism was during the middle decades of the 20th century, its proportions appear less momentous from a longer historical perspective. Evangelical Protestantism had been, in many respects, the folk and civil religion of ordinary Americans since the founding of the Republic. Efforts by mainline Protestants to turn that faith into a well-organized, well-educated, and culturally elite machine were out of sync with evangelicalism's religious and cultural roots. From the revivals of George Whitefield in the colonial era to Billy Graham's urban crusades during the second half of the 20th century, evangelicalism has possessed all the earmarks of a thriving popular culture, in which case the 1920s encounter with modernism may have thrown evangelicalism off its game. But a few defeats in the denominations and the public schools could hardly sap the vigor of born-again Protestantism that by 1925 was almost two centuries old. Evangelical Protestantism emerged in the 18th century in North America during a time of religious fervor known as the First Great Awakening. The leaders of this revival were Jonathan Edwards, a remarkably gifted theologian and philosopher who pastored a church in Northampton, Massachusetts, and George Whitefield, an Anglican priest who came to the colonies in 1739 to raise funding for a new orphanage in Georgia. Along with a myriad of ministers and itinerant preachers, these revivalists sought to shake new life into churches that many believed were cold and formal. Prior to the First Great Awakening, Protestantism was generally hierarchical, liturgical, and learned. Ministers needed to engage in formal training to be ordained. Their sermons were supposed to reflect that learning, and the services they conducted were designed to immerse church members in the beliefs and ceremonies that the clergy prescribed. This kind of Protestantism, whether Episcopalian, Lutheran, Presbyterian, or Reformed, stressed faith as a lifelong struggle with sin and temptation for which the teaching and worship of the church provided relief and encouragement. This older version of Protestantism was objective in the sense that to be a church member involved being conformed to the doctrines and liturgy of the church. It was also corporate in the sense that by participating in the worship of the church, Christians lost some of their individual identity and became a part of a community of believers united by the teaching and ministry of the church. The revival spearheaded by Edwards and Whitefield challenged this older version of Protestantism and introduced the basic dynamics of evangelicalism. Of first importance to this religious awakening was the experience of conversion. Evangelical ministers broke with the received pattern of learned sermons and began to preach in ways designed to bring hearers to a point of crisis where they despaired over their sinfulness and experience the love of God in an immediate and intense manner. Whitfield pioneered in this new form of preaching, expressing the truths of Christianity in the colloquial language of everyday life. Edwards wrote eloquently in defense of conversion as the only sufficient basis for determining authentic faith. But evangelical religion did not stop with the born-again experience. It also included holy living. The leading revivalists expected converts to show dramatically the difference that the new birth made in their lives by exhibiting forms of behavior that were visibly devout, whether by abstaining from certain forms of worldliness or by performing deeds of righteousness. In other words, conversion was such a profound experience that it would immediately be evident to any observer. Evangelicalism's stress upon religious experience and the holy living it produced had important repercussions for historic or older Protestantism. First, it set into motion a demand for all ministers to promote the revivals. If they did not, their devotion to Christianity could easily be questioned. Second, it undermined traditional forms of church life and ministry by making personal experience and good behavior the most important measures of true faith. If the teaching and worship of the existing churches were not producing conversions, then they were guilty of promoting nominal Christianity, a form of faith where believers and clergy simply went through the motions. At the same time, the stress upon holy living meant that what happened in the convert's life during the week was just as pivotal, if not more important than, the activities of the church on Sunday. And by raising questions about the effectiveness of the older forms of Protestantism and the clergy who administered them, evangelicalism's new form of devotion ended up freeing the laity to take control of their religious lives. No longer did Protestant believers need to rely upon the teaching and advice of church officers. The corollary to this freedom was that the Protestant laity were also free to read the Bible for themselves and without having to rely upon the received interpretation or teaching of the church. To be sure, Protestantism had stressed the Bible in contrast to church tradition as the sole authority in religious matters, and so cultivated the practice of Bible reading by the laity and clergy alike. But the established Protestant churches also insisted that clergy possessed legitimate authority to teach and govern the church. Evangelicalism questioned this pattern of governance. George Whitefield summarized the chief impulse of this new form of Protestantism when on September 19, 1740, and I don't know the time of day, he declared, quote, "It was best to preach the new birth and the power of godliness and not to insist so much on the form, for people would never be brought to one mind as to that, nor did Jesus Christ ever intend it," end of quote. Let me read it again. I think it's a really important quotation, and Mark Knoll, in fact, uses this as the defining quote for evangelicalism. Quote, "It was best to preach the new birth and the power of godliness and not to insist so much on the form, for people would never be brought to one mind as to that, nor did Jesus Christ ever intend it." Now, end of quote. Now, he was probably right that people would not be brought to one mind about it, but the real question is whether Jesus Christ intended a formless Christianity. Whitefield's effort to separate the experience of Christianity from its outward observance is what has characterized evangelicalism ever since. As such, born-again Protestantism is essentially a low-church expression of Christianity because what matters most to evangelicals is what occurs not inside the church, but in one's personal affairs. In other words, evangelicalism is synonymous with born-again Protestantism because evangelicals stake the authenticity of Christian faith upon the conversion experience, not baptism. This may also explain why evangelicals are such suckers for sincerity, but I digress. This form of Protestantism emerged from the colonial era, well equipped to become the dominant religious idiom of the United States, thanks not only to the accomplishments of Whitefield and Edwards, but also to crucial developments in the life of the new nation after the War for Independence. The American Revolution had far-reaching implications for religion. One of the most significant was the way the Founding Fathers resolved the dilemma of wanting to encourage religion because of its ethical benefits without actually establishing a state church. By prohibiting congressional support for an established church, the First Amendment to the Constitution made belief voluntary. Churches could not depend on the government for tax subsidies, though some did at the state level for a while. And so these churches were forced to find their own support by attracting adherents. Religious disestablishment played directly into the hands of those Protestants, such as Baptists and Methodists, who were the greatest proponents of evangelicalism's anti-formal and non-liturgical ways. In fact, the fastest growing churches in the first half of the 19th century were those freed from relying upon church hierarchies and established religious practices. The reason for this was evangelicalism's encouragement of the laity to take charge of their religious lives through their own study and forms of devotion. Rather than finding the disestablishment of religion to be a curse, evangelical Protestants actually benefited from the voluntary system of church affiliation. A second important development for evangelicalism after the Revolution was the role that born-again Protestants played in giving order to the new nation. From 1800 to 1860, as Americans attempted to forge a virtuous and free society independent of traditional European authorities, evangelicalism became what one historian has called the functional equivalent of an established church. It did so largely from momentum supplied by the Second Great Awakening, a series of revivals during the 1820s and 1830s, in many respects similar to those of the 18th century, but with even greater social consequences. Born-again Protestants launched a series of social reforms based on the revivalistic premise that conversion leads to righteous lives and holy societies. They formed associations whose purpose was to eliminate every kind of evil, such as slavery, Sabbath breaking, alcohol consumption, and to provide care and education for those in need. Many of the Protestants who supported and worked for this so-called benevolent empire were also active in politics. In the process, evangelicalism became the religious component of a political and social outlook that sought to make the United States a large, efficient, and unified nation, a position embodied in the original Republican Party. Evangelicalism achieved a mainstream status for reasons other than politics. Culturally, the United States prior to the 1920s, some would say until the 1960s even, was primarily the product of Anglo-American Protestants, a group that sociologists have named WASP, that is, White Anglo-Saxon Protestants. In 1892, for instance, when the Supreme Court described the identity of the United States, they did so in the following terms, quote, again, this is the Supreme Court, 1892, "If we pass beyond these matters to a view of American life as expressed by its laws, its business, its customs, and its society, we find everywhere a clear recognition of the same truth. Among other matters, note the following. The form of oath universally prevailing, concluding with an appeal to the Almighty. The custom of opening sessions of all deliberative bodies and most conventions with prayer. The prefatory words of all wills, in the name of God, amen. The laws respecting the observance of the Sabbath, with the general cessation of all secular business, and the closing of courts, legislatures, and other similar public assemblies on that day. These and many other matters which might be noticed add a volume of unofficial declarations to the mass of organic utterances that this is a Christian nation." End of quote. This understanding of American culture helps to explain the comments of foreign observers who were regularly struck by the United States' high degree of religiosity. Lord James Bryce, a British visitor in the late 19th century, observed in his book, The American Commonwealth, quote, "The whole matter may, I think, be summed up by saying that Christianity is in fact to be understood, though not legally the established religion, yet the national religion," end of quote. Americans, he added, deemed the general acceptance of Christianity to be one of the main sources of their national prosperity and their nation a special object of divine favor. If readers of Bryce's book wondered about the Christianity of which he wrote, André Siegfried, a French visitor, writing almost four decades later, asserted emphatically in America Comes of Age that no one can possibly understand the United States without a profound, almost innate appreciation of their Puritanism. Although Siegfried may not have understood all of the nuances of English-speaking Protestantism, his use of Puritanism indicated that the faith he had in mind was the revivalist Anglo-American one that had shaped the nation's outlook on moral problems. Few dispute the impact that evangelicalism had on the United States during the century after the nation's founding. But the nature of evangelical Protestantism's influence has not always been sufficiently appreciated. What made born-again Protestantism so successful in its penetration of American society was its independence from such traditional structures of historic Christianity as church officers, official creeds, and formal liturgies. Had evangelical leaders needed to rely upon trained clergy, constructing church buildings, and circulating the same hymnals or books of prayer, the scope of their influence would likely have been significantly diminished. But the main point of born-again Protestantism was that the formalities of official Protestantism were not as important as the average Christian's daily experience. Evangelical Protestantism was and continues to be a relevant faith that informs all walks of life. As such, it could not be confined to the official activities of a specific denomination, but actually extended its influence wherever born-again Protestants took it. Because of evangelicalism's inherent informality, along with the zeal it inspired for transforming every realm of life according to biblical truth, this form of Protestantism had nowhere to go except outside the churches and into society. The skeptical Baltimore journalist H.L. Mencken captured well the genius of evangelicalism in a column he wrote on the baseball player turned evangelist Billy Sunday. In trying to account for Sunday's appeal, Mencken, who generally took a dim view of most forms of Christian devotion, appreciated the evangelical knack for stripping the gospel of its mystery and holiness and refashioning it as an ordinary, even pedestrian, phenomenon. According to Mencken, quote, "Setting aside his painstaking avoidance of anything suggesting clerical garb and his indulgence in the obviously unclerical gyration on his sacred stump, Sunday comes down so palpably to the level of his audience, both in the matter and the manner of his discourse, that he quickly disarms the old suspicion of the holy clerk and gets the discussion going on the familiar and easy terms of a debate in a bar room. The raciness of his slang is not the whole story by any means. His attitude of mind lies behind it, and it is important. It is marked above all by a contemptuous disregard of the theoretical and mystifying, an angry casting aside of what may be called the ecclesiastical mask, an eagerness to reduce the abstrusities of Christian theology to a few and simple and to the ingenuous self-evident propositions of a practical and imminent an everyday concern," end of quote. Here, Sunday was no different from his evangelical predecessors, from George Whitfield and Charles Grandison Finney to Dwight L. Moody and Billy Graham. Evangelicals have been successful by positioning the Christian religion as a popular, democratic, and highly accessible faith. The import of this vulgarization of Christianity by evangelicals is, like most things in life, a mixed blessing. On the one hand, the success of evangelicals in popularizing Christianity helps to explain why a nation with a relatively secular founding has such a remarkably vigorous religious life. According to Nathan Hatch, whose book, The Democratization of American Christianity, after almost two decades, remains essential reading, he writes, quote, "In the realms of high culture, in the best universities, in the arts, in literary circles, religious values are no more pervasive in the United States than in England," end of quote. But as one moves down the social scale, religion in America thrives, while in Great Britain the working classes have been almost completely de-Christianized. The reason for this difference, Hatch argues, is that America's democratic and populist social orientation included forms of popular religion that bound, quote, "paradoxical extremes together, such as the reassertion of the reality of the supernatural in everyday life with the quintessentially modern values of autonomy and popular sovereignty, end of quote. No group of believers was better at combining the paradoxical elements, these paradoxical elements, than the proponents of born-again Protestantism. On the other hand, this democratic and popular form of Christianity made life extremely difficult for confessional Protestants like Lutherans and Reformed Christians who practice a churchly as opposed to an individualistic faith. David Gustafson spelled out this difficulty well several years ago in his book on 19th century American Lutheranism and the controversy that ensued. According to Gustafson, Lutherans in America had trouble retaining their identity against the Protestant mainstream. That American Protestant faith was characterized, according to Gustafson, by vehement anti-Catholicism, the right to private judgment in matters of biblical interpretation and doctrine, conversion as necessary for salvation, and a Zwinglian or symbolic understanding of the sacraments. The controversy between Lutheran leaders like Samuel Schmucker and Charles Porterfield Krauth concerned the degree to which Lutherans could accommodate the American Protestant mainstream, especially if it meant yielding their confessional loyalty and liturgical order. Eventually, the two parties in American Lutheranism, the Americanizers and the confessionalists, needed to separate because harmoning American mainstream Protestantism, and I'm arguing that is evangelicalism, harmonizing evangelicalism and Lutheranism was impossible. What is especially important for my purposes about Gustafson's book is his identification of the Protestant mainstream. The evangelical faith that revivalists such as George Whitefield and Charles Finney forged and later inherited and resurrected by the neo-evangelical movement of the 1940s and 1950s was the mainstream faith in the United States at least until the first decades of the 20th century. Conversely, confessional Protestantism of the Lutheran, Anglican, or Reformed varieties was the minority or side stream. But because evangelicalism since the 1940s has identified itself as the conservative version of American Protestantism, confessional Lutherans and Reformed, the truly conservative Protestants, have either been classified as evangelicals or ignored. The trouble with lumping confessional Protestants with evangelicals is, as Gustafson well shows, that confessionalists oppose the anti-creedalism, anti-clericalism, and anti-ritualism that has characterized American evangelicalism. But if confessional groups are not evangelical, the only other category seemingly available to religion scholars is liberal, an identity that again makes no sense of Protestants who are trying to conserve a traditional faith. In fact, the very impoverishment of language and categories to account for older pre-revivalist forms of Protestantism suggests how powerful the American Protestant mainstream was and continues to be. Scholars and journalists may not know it, but 19th century evangelical Protestants established the terms that we continue to use to analyze American religion. It is a broad, lowest common denominator faith that pays little attention to liturgical, creedal, or ecclesial convictions so long as a person has a personal relationship with Jesus. This mainstream evangelical faith is very easy to join and almost possible to leave. But for groups outside its devotional and evangelistic instincts, the mainstream is surprisingly callous and indifferent. To call inevitable the resurrection of neo-evangelicalism from the grave of fundamentalism is to slight the labors of those neo-evangelical leaders who articulated the vision and organized the institutions that brought born-again Protestantism back from ill repute. But from the longer perspective of American Protestantism, the reemergence of evangelicalism into the mainstream of American religion should not have taken anyone by surprise. Born-again Protestantism's powers of adaptation were too fit not simply to survive, but also to thrive. Now some concluding remarks. I want to close by trying to give an example of evangelicalism's return as a mainstream faith, evidence that suggests why it has such staying power, despite setbacks like those encountered by fundamentalism, or even those more recently like those by Ted Haggard. I began by taking note of Protestants on the cover of Time magazine. I will end by referring to the cover story of another weekly magazine, namely Business Week, On May 23, 2005, evangelical Protestantism was the cover story of the weekly news magazine devoted to business. It is not impossible to imagine a story on the business of selling John Paul II or Benedict XVI paraphernalia. And I wouldn't be surprised if Dr. Scare has some of that. Less plausible is the idea of a story devoted to the entrepreneurial genius of mainline Protestants. But to capture the essence of evangelicalism by looking at the way it mimics free market capitalism is to notice what makes born-again Protestantism so ubiquitous and apparently successful. In many respects, the spread of stories in Business Week offered few surprises to those who make a living chronicling evangelical Protestantism in the United States. The prominence of Joel Osteen, Bill Hybels, and Rick Warren in the reports suggested that the magazine's reporters were not in search of a Pulitzer Prize. When William C. Simons, the main reporter, wrote that Osteen, for instance, is one of a new generation of evangelical entrepreneurs transforming their branch of Protestantism into one of the fastest growing and most influential religious groups in America, he showed no awareness that revivalism, going back to Whitfield, had been grounded on market economics. But when Simons compared megachurches to Home Depot and evangelical church planning to opening up branches of Subways, he did capture the scope of evangelical Protestant big business. As such, evangelicals have emerged as the Walmarts of American Protestantism compared to mainline Protestant corporate dinosaurs like the United Methodists or the Episcopal Church, the religious equivalents of General Motors. Pastors interviewed for Business Week did not seem to flinch or be embarrassed by the comparison of soul winning to marketing and sales. According to Hybels, most evangelicals who are of the entrepreneurial bent see their risk-taking and experimentation with new ministry models as an appropriate response to the mandate of Scripture to go out and do what is necessary to spread the word to as many as possible. Rick Warren was equally unashamed of the comparison. Quote, "We've always been entrepreneurial," he told the reporter, "but 50 years ago, most of the evangelical entrepreneurs went into evangelical organizations like Campus Crusade for Christ, World Vision, etc. The spirit used to be that you had to leave the church, but now all the smart guys I know are going out to become pastors and starting churches." End of quote. And that's a scary thought. Warren concedes a danger in turning the church into a business. But for the megachurch style of evangelical ministry, the peril is not the pastor as religious hucksters like Elmer Gantry. Instead, as Kurt Friedrichsen of Fuller Seminary explained to one reporter, quote, "We have to be careful when a pastor moves into the CEO mode and becomes too market-oriented, or there might be a reaction against megachurches just as there is against Walmart." End of quote. So the problem isn't whether the pastor is cooking the books for personal profit. It is mainly one of perception, whether the public will regard the pastor as having gone corporate, that is, become part of a structure inaccessible to the peeps or the ordinary people. The fact that a Business Weekly would devote its cover to evangelicalism as a successful corporate and marketing enterprise is testimony to why born-again Protestantism was and ever shall be in the mainstream of United States society. As long as evangelicals continue to devise new means for spreading the message of Christianity, irrespective of whether that message is correct, their faith will be popular and easily accessible. Whether evangelicalism can remain faithful to Jesus while making him popular is a question to which American church history has yielded many answers. Most of those answers involve a faith much less fastidious about correct faith and practice. But because of the highly innovative ways of translating Christianity into the vernacular of a liberal, democratic, market-oriented superpower, the people who analyze evangelicalism are far more intrigued by the novelty than perplexed by the infidelity that usually accompanies such innovation. Even so, what the editor of the New Republic remarked about George W. Bush while governor of Texas applies equally well to evangelical Protestantism. When Bush officially declared June 11th, 2000, as Jesus Day, a holiday dedicated to Jesus Christ's example of love, compassion, sacrifice, and service. The New Republic's editor quipped that instead of glorifying Jesus, Bush actually cheapened the eternal Son of God. Such trivialization of the gospel is usually what happens when it becomes mainstream. For some reason, however, evangelicals have rarely considered whether the mainstreaming of Christianity is simply the way the salt loses its savor. Thank you.
Very nice. Very good. Fun. I just would like to point out that it was Dr. Hart who mentioned Samuel Simon Schmucker and Charles Grandison Finney this year. Neither of those names appeared in my paper, so many thanks. We'll take questions for Dr. Hart after Dr. Broughton's presentation, so we'll get those together, and there you go. Again, let's thank Dr. Hart one more time, please.